is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, I have to admit, they're getting harder and harder to find these days. I'm talking about anybody that remains bullish on the stock market. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Joining me on the program this week, in the first hour, will be Bullseye Craig Johnson, or what I call the last bull standing. He's probably one of the more optimistic strategists that we talk to here on the program on the stock market. Craig is still sticking to his target of $23.50 on the stock market by year end. You're going to want to hear what his justifications are, and it's not just looking at the charts. There are other reasons why he feels that way. He's coming up in hour one, and Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about the market moving events in the week. And at the end of the first hour, I'll be speaking with energy analyst Kurt Wolf. We're going to be talking about this current pop in oil. Some, like Jeffrey Gundlach, think that oil has bottomed. We're trading above $30. I guess that's the best news. We'll talk about investments in the energy sector, where we think energy prices are going. And of course, if you are investing in the sector, what dividends are really safe at this point? All of that coming up in a special edition of the Financial News Hour in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. Coming up in the second hour of the program, we have an interesting interview with Gary Schilling. That'll be the big picture for today, discussing his new book, The Age of Deleveraging, The Demise of OPEC, and The Sunset of China. I guarantee it's going to be something you should be looking forward to. And Ryan Poplava, big question here. What happened to the bulls from last week, Ryan? I mean, it's somebody's fumbled the ball is what it looks like.
Yeah. You know, it looks like they had to punt essentially on Monday. You know, come on, guys, call an audible. Just do something. We're trying to build a little bottom here. You know, the bulls really just continue to play defense, it seems, doesn't it, John? I mean, you know, speaking of football, are you even ready for the Super Bowl weekend?
Yeah, we have to be, because a lot of the people in my family are Broncos fans. So unfortunately, I have to endure this weekend.
You're not going skiing?
Matter of fact, no, we have a lot of relatives coming over for that time. So I think we're just going to be here and do it. You know, I do get interested when the Broncos finally make it, because when we were in Denver for a bunch of times, they kept going to the Super Bowl and losing. And I finally, this is when Elway was still there. And I said, the last time they did that, where they did win, I said, if they don't win this time, I am never watching another Broncos game ever again, ever in my life.
I've been there, being a San Diego Charger
fan.
Yeah, that gets me to thinking, you know, do you think there's a demand for you and I maybe to do a play-by-play commentary on the market? Is that something maybe our listeners would want to hear?
I think the action's a little slow in some cases.
It is. Yeah, it can right be. Now. Watching grass grow a little bit on some of the charts, but I don't know.
I don't think it
I
would
guess
work.
There's CNBC, but...
Let's get back on the task. Let's see. Another volatile week in the market. Some real interesting moves in currencies and commodities this week. We haven't seen gold rally and the dollar correct this way in some time. So, since all of this is going on, what do you suppose the catalyst is that's moving the markets in those areas, Ryan?
Well, John, it's basically, I think, investors and traders that have been hiding out in this trade, which was the strong dollar. The reason why they're there is a difference in policy from the Federal Reserve Bank here in the U.S. versus the ECB and the Bank of Japan, very large central banks kind of governing a lot of currency moves there. And that has been in play for some time. And it may probably be a little bit overcrowded because it has been just a one-way street since, I think summer of 2014. And that was when the ECB really announced that it was planning to make some really big accommodative moves to stimulate their economy. And at the time, they were talking about possibly outright QE, just as we were rolling up our program. So the strong dollar, that was definitely, like I said, a one-way trade for a long time. And that was from the summer all the way till about March 2015 last year.
Yeah, you mean during the Fed meeting? What's the reason it stopped there anyway?
That was it. The Fed meeting in March was pretty important. I think you and I talked about it on the show because we talked about the dot plots dropping. And that was a very significant thing. The dot plots is what the Federal Reserve, all the different voting members in there, give you an estimate of where they think interest rates will be by the Fed at the end of the year, and it had dropped from 1.125% all the way down to 0.625%. That was a big drop. And the reason why they did that was based on all the cold weather we had that had really affected the economy at the beginning of the year, like it did in 2014. So 2014 winter, first quarter, pretty bad economics, same thing last year. And so they adjusted their outlook. In the same way, you know, this week's economic numbers are shedding doubt the Fed will be able to really continue to raise rates at a gradual pace, because we have been seeing some weak numbers since January, but the ISM service index has been decelerating. When that number came out, we really saw a big drop in the dollar. And it wasn't just that. I think it was also the ADP private payrolls report, which also underachieved what the market was expecting. And so those two numbers really hit the tape, and we really saw the dollar, you know, break down. Overall, you know, economic numbers, like I said, since January, they continue to point towards continued deceleration. I think that ISM number, you know, it dropped from 55.3 to 53.5. So a decent drop, and you know, we've had a clear downtrend. If you look at that indicator itself, tracking it month by month, it's been dropping since really when it hit a high in last July, right around 59. Anything above 50 is good. That means expansion, but the whole idea that it's decelerating, that has a lot of bulls concerned. And that was, I think, the one leg that bulls had to stand on, that they can say, hey, don't worry about manufacturing over here. 70% of the economy is doing great over here.
Nothing like propping yourself up, right? Okay, so the dollar weakened this week in a rather significant way, and that did lead to strength in many commodities, like there was oil and crude and even copper.
Yeah. In fact, John, that was probably the most interesting side of the market this week, not to mention some of the weakness we saw on Friday. Maybe we can go into that in a second. But gold stocks are breaking out of short-term ranges that I've been following for some time. I've been really focusing on that in October of last year, and then also early in January with some of my technical analysis for our firm. And is currently now moving up to test some of those significant resistance levels, that October or November high, I forget which, October probably. And there was a big move in those stocks this week as we saw the dollar drop, those trades kind of unwinding, all of the bullishness in the dollar strength. And obviously the other part of that pair trade on the other side of it is shorting commodities. So let's say you're a hedge fund and you're playing both of those. It's the same strategy, right? Strong dollar, weak commodities. You got to unwind that whole position. So we definitely saw that, a big squeeze in material stocks. Even Caterpillar moved up really nicely on Wednesday and Thursday. I think Joy Global, some of these infrastructure type play names, global growth names that a lot of people played back in the commodity boom, those moved up. That's why the Dow Jones Industrial Average did fairly well midweek on a Wednesday and Thursday based off of all that movement in the commodities. So it definitely was interesting. You know, the other area, John, besides commodities that has actually piqued my interest a little bit is the few retailers that have been staging some little stealth rallies here, that I call it. And, you know, it could be a dead cat bounce, very likely could be, but it does appear that some investors are nibbling on those areas. You know, they're down 75%, 50%, and worse for some of the smaller ones. But I think retail sales came out this week on a couple, and I think Zumiez was one of the few that was actually positive on same stores. So still some weakness there overall. But like I said, I definitely see some nibbling going on there, or maybe some short covering. On the flip side, we saw some big sales on Friday, John, like I mentioned, and that was all in tech and a lot of momentum names. And that was on the heels of some bad earnings prints we got from LinkedIn and Tableau Software. I think the symbol on that is data, DATA. So cloud stocks got hit. Salesforce was down, breaking below some support levels, down, I think, 12% of the day, and a few other big names. Facebook, even, which had great earnings and has been touted as maybe recession retardant. I don't know what the correct word is to use there. You know, essentially, Facebook was doing well after its earnings, and that had some weakness this week as well. NASDAQ closed down 3.25%, John, while the S&P 500 only fell down 1.85% on Friday. So definitely the weakness was in tech.
Could we say that the market might still be taking its cue from oil? Because I remember you talked a lot about the rumors last week about OPEC cuts, and you disagreed with the rumors, citing many officials from OPEC on Friday actually rejected the notion of any kind of a cut.
Yeah, the correlation is still very high, and I haven't seen a big drop yet. look at Friday's trading. The market was down. Gold was up. Dollar was up and crude oil was down. So yeah, John, I think this week, a lot of kind of bipolar movements in the market, both in the dollar, the economy, the idea of what's going on behind there. Was the jobs data strong or was it weak? You know, there was a lot of debate, but I think if you look at the markets, the dollar was strong. There's something that is to be telling there. But, you know, oil and the dollar were the start of the current earnings recession story, I believe. And they'll be, I think, the concluding chapter, right? We'll have to see things there resolve. Obviously, production needs to be cut so we can have some sort of balance and equilibrium. We don't have that yet. There have been some catalysts on both sides of that oil trade recently, but long-term issues are still there. So, like I said, no signs of production cuts from OPEC. Last week was their chance to really, I think, come to the table with something substantial to say, maybe back up what that Russian was saying about possible production cuts of 5%. But yeah, you know, we think it's a good idea to stop maybe our dumping policy. But, you know, as I said last week, they're not worried about the U.S. right now. They have gained over us. They've seen the drop in our production. That was their intended consequence of dropping oil on our markets, continuing their high levels of production. They're not worried about us. They're worried about Iran and losing market share to Iran. Also with the political conflicts we see in the Middle East, in Syria, and with ISIS, they don't want to lose that market share to Iran. You know, falling dollar would help oil, but I'm not so sure, you know, 2 days makes a trend. We had a big drop on Wednesday, big drop on Thursday, rally on Friday. Has the trend broken? No, it has not. We've been going sideways in the dollar index for some time. If you look at the trade weighted dollar index, that actually broke out last month. But technically, it's good to see that an area of the market where we're getting technically overbought ratings is commodities and materials, gold. That's the one area I'd say that we're actually getting technically overbought ratings. Not a lot of areas that we can say the same thing about. Now, I'd say the intermediate term outlook on metals has improved a lot this week, and they're heading straight for some previous highs, those October levels, I believe. So, you know, I think if we are able to backfill maybe a little bit below those October highs and then maybe break out above them, well, then there you go. You've got the confirmation of a long-term bottom in gold.
Okay, next week, investors should be looking towards what?
Well, John, I think all eyes are going to shift and really focus in on the dollar. And the dollar could drive strength or weakness, both in oil, I think, as well as in gold and metals in general are in play. So the big catalyst next week is going to be the Fed chair, Janet Yellen's testimony with Congress. So I think, you know, expectations will be for a less dovish Yellen, given the drop in the unemployment rate we saw on Friday in the jobs report and the rise in hourly earnings. And I think her testimony will be the next clue investors are looking for on their dollar and commodity trades. And as of Friday, you know, I know sentiment and uncertainty is shifting almost daily here, John. I think expectations are more in line with what the Fed may do this year, given the Friday's jobs report. If you would have asked me on Wednesday with the services index, with some of the ISM numbers from earlier in the week, as well as the ADP jobs report, which was underwhelming, you know, I'd say that the outlook is pretty grim and that the expectations, you know, if you look at the Fed funds rates, probabilities of Fed hikes for the rest of this year were really low. I think those are going to come up now a little bit. I think there's going to be some concerns about what Yellen focuses on, not just what the market focuses in on when it comes to jobs and employment and the justification for why they raised in December. So I think testimony going to be very important. I think all traders will be definitely focusing that, and that I think it'll move the markets most likely. So watch the reactions. That'll be important.
And never a lack of anything to talk about. Ryan Poplava, appreciate it.
It seems to always be about the Fed.
I wonder why that is. Been there, done that.
Yeah, I think for the last 5 years, you and I, we've talked about a lot of things, but it seems like the Fed is always one component.
And it's always going to be, since it sets monetary policy and that affects everything else.
Yeah. Sure does.
Cannot avoid it. Okay, Ryan, good weekend.
You too.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Lakshman Achuthan joins us today. He's the co-founder of ECRI, which stands for Economic Cycle Research Institute. And the ECRI focuses on leading economic indicators for tracking business cycles around the globe. And Lakshman, I want to get your thoughts on the U.S. economy in terms of your outlook for 2016. Are you seeing a pickup, a stabilization, or a decline in the U.S. economy? And what are some of the things that you're looking at in terms of your outlook?
Well, in terms of where we are in the cycle, it's really a continuation of what we're seeing in 2015, which is a slowdown in the growth rate of the economy. Really, since the beginning of last year, if you can believe it, since the beginning of 2015, we've been seeing the coincident indicators of economic growth slowing. And that continues into 2016. It follows the path of what our forward-looking indicators were suggesting. And today, those forward-looking indicators continue to ease in their growth rate. So the bottom line is that the growth rate cycle downturn, or the slowing of overall economic growth, is going to continue. It's not over yet.
Given what's happened with the stock market since the beginning of the year, we're still in negative territory. It's a very rare breed today to find a bull who's on the market. And we have just the man to talk to today. In fact, some in the media would call him a raging bull because he's positive on stocks. Joining us on the program is Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. Craig, I guess a lot of listeners would want to know, have you gone from standing bull to sitting bull, given what's happened to the markets this year?
Thanks, Jim. You know, we are still positive on this market, so we are still standing long and loud and proud that we think that this secular bull market is still very much intact. Where we are at this point in time, though, is when you go back and you look at a 20-year chart of, say, the S&P 500, you tend to get these breakouts out of big consolidation range like you did from 2000 until 2013, and you ultimately have to get some sort of shakeout. And we are in that process of shaking out the weak hands and owners in the marketplace right now. And clearly that's working very well, given all the noise, the concerns, the challenges that we're seeing in the market. And, you know, very few people think that equities can ever work or ever work again. So, yeah, we're still bullish, and the shakeout has not deterred our bullish viewpoint or stance on the broader market. And, you know, frankly, we're comfortable being out of consensus. We're less comfortable being in consensus because, as you know, when you're in consensus, you're usually never right.
You know, Craig, and just for our listeners, you know, who think sometimes people are perpetually bullish on Wall Street, you were also a major bear. And tell folks, because we've had this conversation before, what was it in 2007? Remember your lawn mowing story about being bearish at the time everybody was bullish on the market?
Yeah, you know, Jim, that's a very, very good point. Back in 2007, we saw a divergence between the financial sector and the overall broader market. And when I talk about a divergence, I'm not talking large cap. I'm talking about the average financial stock. And we saw that divergence happening, and it was an indication of something more serious happening in the overall market. Back then, we got underweight equities, raised our maximum cash, and stepped aside. There's no comparison at all to today's market to what you had seen in 2008 and 2009. This is not some sort of large financial crisis or a collapse of our financial system like almost happened in 08 and 09. This is a market that is, you know, frankly, lacking a little bit of growth in here right now. And there's concerns about the rapid sell-off in the commodity sector weighing on other sectors of the market. But this is not the same as what you'd seen in 08 and 09. And this market does not deserve to trade, and I don't think will trade at multiples like you had seen in 08 and 09. To me, this is one of these corrections within the context of a longer-term secular bull. And I think for those investors that can stomach it, you want to be selectively buying good quality companies on this pullback. And I think when you look back in, say, 24 or 36 months or even less, you're going to be quite happy with those purchases that you made here during this period of uncertainty.
You know, Craig, you have both a technical background and a fundamental background, both a CFA and a CMT. Tell me, what is it that you see? Okay, you're looking at the charts, as you just mentioned. What is it that you're seeing that keeps you in that bullish camp besides just the charts? In other words, are you basing any of this on, let's say, fundamental factors that keep you invested?
Yeah, Jim, there's a couple things. Number one, let's start with the chart. So what I do see when you go back and you look at that longer term chart of the S&P going back 20 years, this looks like one of these markets where you are getting that kind of pullback, correction, retest. Similar to what you had seen at the early stages of the secular bull market that had started in the early 1980s and also the early 1950s. The second thing that I'm seeing from the charts is if you draw an uptrend support line off the right shoulder of the inverted head and shoulders low that was made in 08 and 09, and you carry that trend lined up, the market has been obeying and respecting that uptrend support line. Also, I'd mention that support at 1880, 1820 have been some pretty meaningful support levels for the market. And so far, when you step back and look at a multi-year weekly or monthly chart, you'll see that you've not made and undercut those lows you've seen in 2014 or 2015 at this point in time. We've pulled back and successfully retested them. That's technically what's keeping me in the market. Now, from a market internals perspective, Jim, at this point in time, we have very few groups that still remain above a 40-week moving average. And for your listeners, we've often talked and measured for 40-plus years at Piper Jaffray. We've looked at what the percent of our industry groups and stocks are above their 40-week moving average. And we have found that when you start getting readings around 20%, the market gets a little bit jittery, and then you enter some sort of final washout. We've already gone into that washout phase, and as of the last week or so, we've only had like 6 to 7% of our groups still remaining above their 40-week moving average. Jim, this has only happened 20 times over the last 40, 45 years, and this indicator rarely goes to zero. It went to zero in 2008, 2009 and stayed there for a while, and then it also went to zero in 1987. I don't think that the scenario and the setup that we are in right now, that indicator deserves to go to zero. Call it a judgment call, call it what you like, but I guess history is on my side saying the bad news has already been priced into this market. And again, looking out 13 weeks from where we are now, the market has been higher almost 80% of the time with a high single-digit return. Again, I want to be buying when other people are selling, and I want to be selling when other people are buying. Again, I'm not trying to be a contrarian, but I just think we got to take into consideration market sentiment, and right now, it's awfully doom and gloom, and I don't think you're going to get a boom.
You know, Craig, let me bring up something that various technicians have raised in terms of looking at this market from a bearish perspective, and that has been the terrible breath in the market on these rallies. What's your take on that?
Interesting. Along these lines of breath, we've seen the Russell, the mid-small cap stocks sell off very hard relative to, call it, the larger cap stocks throughout the marketplace. What I have found with the help of colleagues and people we know like Sam Stovall, that when the breadth of the market is bad and you're seeing mid-small cap stocks coming down, it's only about 50% of the time that you then ultimately see the large cap stocks also brought down with it. Most technicians have thought previously that that was a pretty high correlation, closer to one, but really it's only about a 50% probability that you'll see this coming down. Again, what I'm seeing that other technicians perhaps are not seeing is I'm recognizing the breadth is bad. It's already been bad. We've seen huge sell-offs in energy, basics, even the transportation areas of the marketplace. And again, summing up 5,000 plus stocks that we have in our project, Jim, a lot of these stocks are already off appreciably. The average stock in the market is already sold off over 20 plus percent. So again, how much of the damage is already in? And again, do we need to bring down the large cap stocks? History says only 50% of the time you do. I'm betting that this is not a financial crisis based upon our work. And I think this is a shakeout of the weaker hands. And again, I get it, the breath is bad, but I'd rather be buying than selling stocks in here.
Well, I mean, when we look at what some of the alternatives are, especially when you would take a look at the yields on treasuries, 10-year yield at 1.87 doesn't offer much to tie up your money for 10 years. Craig, if you were buying stocks, you talk about good quality stocks. I mean, the amazing thing that I'm seeing, for the first time in my investment career, the dividend yields on high quality stocks are so much better than what you can get on, let's say, treasury bonds. And that's just looking here. I mean, if you go to Europe and Asia, you have negative yields, which is even worse. Imagine paying the government. You loan the government money and you pay them interest instead of getting interest. So stocks, for the first time in, 30, 40 years, are offering investors yields that are so much greater than what you can get on a bond.
Well, Jim, that's a terrific observation and a terrific point to play off of. And, you know, a couple things come into mind for me here. You're right. This is a TINA market. There is no alternative. If you are looking for income, which I know a lot of your listeners are, Jim, it's staggering to me that it's been over 10 years that we've had a sub 5% 10-year bond yield in the U.S. And a lot of individual investors have felt a lot of undue pain over the last year or so as a lot of these energy stocks have rolled over and these MLPs have rolled over and these things have all sold off. So there's been a tremendous amount of pain under there that I certainly feel for all the individual investors that are looking for the income. And they've moved in out of energy, they've moved over into the consumer staples areas, and they've moved over in utilities and other places. But it is a big challenge. And I think going to negative rates in the last week by the Bank of Japan and the negative rates you're seeing on some of the German bonds, it really comes back to this, is that there's plenty of money in the system. That's not the problem. The problem is we need some changes. We need some changes among the politicians around the world to create confidence, to get people to want to step up and invest. Keep in mind that it's the politicians that have ultimately created 401k plans and moved us away from pensions. They put people into healthcare savings accounts away from more managed care type programs. And at this point in time, people have more money in the market than they have ever had before. And they need to have real returns. And right now, with interest rates where they are, we need to see spending coming up and we need confidence. And there is a lack of confidence. That's why the velocity of money is so slow, that people are sitting on it. And again, in Japan, it's been happening for years. They've been sitting on a lot of money, not doing anything, cutting at the negative interest rates. They're hoping that that actually spurs some spending among investors as they make a rational decision to move that money off the sidelines and do something with it.
Craig, what about some of the other markets? And I want to get your take here. The stock market, it seems lately, has been highly correlated with what's going on in the oil market. Oil prices rally, you see a rally in the stock market. What's your take on that in terms of the correlation? It seems like the stock market is viewing oil as a proxy for economic growth. Oil rises, the stock market goes up, oil falls, the stock market goes down. How do you view that?
Jim, this comes back to this correlation, and yes, you're correct. It has gone to a correlation of one recently. The decision process that I think about with this, though, is this a demand issue or is this a supply issue? And a lot of very smart economists and scholars will go back and forth on this issue. I would, in my humble opinion, put this into a supply issue with new supply coming online from Iran and other places around the world. It's clear that the cartel called OPEC is trying to squeeze out the higher cost production for them to continue to maintain market share. Very difficult to come up with a rational solution and a rational justification for oil prices when you have a cartel that wants to squeeze out that marginal producer. Second thing is that observe, Jim, is that when you go and you look at some of the frontier markets, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, and all these others, Kuwait, and you look at their markets, these markets are off 3 to 4x what we've seen in the U.S. off of their peaks. So we are seeing this correlation very high as people are raising cash, they're getting margin calls on some of those energy positions, and they're selling other stocks to cover some of those margin calls. And again, who's getting caught in the crossfire on some of this? Some of the individual investors that have bought those MLPs, pipelines, and other companies for yield and income. And again, they're seeing and feeling some of that pain too. I do ultimately think, though, that this correlation is going to have to break because based upon the charts, it looks like oil could trade all the way down to $14 to $17 before this final shakeout is done, just purely based upon the charts, Jim. And I don't think we're going to cut in half equity markets from here. So I think as some of these margin calls and these other selling, forced selling gets cleaned out, that correlation will go back to what it normally has been between about 0.4 and about 0.6 longer term.
So if this correlation breaks, as you can say, there's a couple of ways it could go, but it seems to me if it breaks on the upside, it would be more positive for the market. Let's talk a little bit about the Fed, because we spent the whole year last year talking about will they or will they not. They finally did. Now there's a little bit of thought going out there that maybe they shouldn't have done that, and maybe they might be pulling back. Would you see that as a positive catalyst for stocks? In other words, if we're to take off and get to your number, 2350, what are some of the catalysts that we need to see in order for this number to be reached?
Yeah, so is the Fed going to go back and reverse course? I think the answer to that is no. The Fed is not going to go back and reverse course. This is a 25 basis point increase that they have put into play. By historical standards, they're still very accommodative. And if they reverse course and went down 25 basis points, I don't think it's going to make a material difference by cutting rates by 25 basis points. It would simply be an admission of guilt that they made the wrong decision. If it was the wrong decision, it was an admission that it was. And I just don't see them cutting. You know, I would say that perhaps some of the future rate hikes that they've talked about may get pushed out to later into 2016, or maybe even slip into 2017. But I don't see them coming back and reversing course. Now, to get to 2350 by year end, what needs to happen? Well, I think we need to see some sort of indication that the economy is showing some signs of strength. Second, I think what we need to see ultimately happen is that interest rates can work their way higher, which would be an indication, again, supporting the thesis that the economy is getting a little bit better, not worse. And I also think as you roll out and think about earnings estimates throughout 2016, you know, recognition that the earnings estimates get a lot easier in the second half of 2016 for energy, basic materials, and some of the most beaten up areas of the market than what we've had over the last couple of years. So I think it's really going to be a combination of that point in time, looking out to 2017, seeing a little bit of visibility on the horizon, and I think that's where we're going to get to that particular number. And again, selling in oil and other things will have been largely washed out after you get to that $14 to $17 level.
So we talked about buying high-quality stocks, and we also mentioned that dividends, for the first time, at least in our investment careers, are offering better yields to investors. Craig, you know, thinking from a positive perspective, when do you want to buy stocks? You want to buy them when they're down. It's like buying something on sale. Assuming that we hit that number later on in the year, that things improve, on these dips or these corrective phases that we go through, what would you be buying here? In other words, what sectors look the most favorable from, let's say, a value perspective, technical perspective going forward?
We see the best relative strength right now inside of the technology sector. We like financials, specifically the mid-small financials, still look good to us. And we still see good relative strength in healthcare, albeit a little bit more large cap than mid-small. On the weaker side, I would say that energy, basic materials, and transportation are still among the weaker areas for us. I am worried about, on a valuation standpoint, the historically high valuation you're seeing in the consumer staples sector. And to me, that's in a place where a lot of your listeners, Jim, have probably been looking and hiding out and seeking yield in their portfolios. And, you know, take this as a strong warning sign that if rates do go up and you do see, as some people have just recently said, 10-year bond yields working closer to 3%. That's not our call. We're not quite that aggressive. But if you do see that happen, I would think staples and utilities will become a source of profit taking. But those are some of the areas, Jim, that I would really strongly encourage your listeners to focus in on.
All right, Craig. And given that you still hold a positive view, let me just ask you one final question. What would it take to cause you to change that view? In other words, what needs to happen for you to say, you know what, I need to change my views based on what I'm seeing? What would be the key to changing that view?
One is on the interest rate side and the other one is on the technical side. So, Jim, if we start seeing, you know, interest rates trading below the July 2012 lows around 130 and change on the 10-year bond yield. You know, we're entering something that's going to be a much longer process to dig out of. And it would certainly raise questions among investors about, wow, maybe we are Japan once again. The second thing that would start to change my opinion is if in this pullback / cyclical, I didn't say secular, but cyclical correction, we start undercutting, you know, 1575, 1550, where we broke out from in 2013, that's going to suggest to me from a technical perspective that this was a failed topside breakout and that was going to take more time consolidating inside of the long trading range we endured from 2000 to 2013. And that's the two things that would have to really change my perspective on this market. But at this point in time, that's not the case. And this really looks to me like one of these corrections within the context of a longer-term secular bull.
All right, Craig. We're going to stay with that. Like I say, you're one of the rare breeds on Wall Street today. It's very hard to have somebody that has a bullish outlook. If our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
A couple different ways. Number one, they can send an email to myself, craig.w.johnson@pjc.com, and I'd be happy to have some conversations. You could also reach out to our institutional sales force at Piper Jaffray, and they'd be happy to get you signed up for our work.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Dr. David Bush. He's chairman of the Department of Radiation at Loma Linda University Medical Center. Doctor, those are some big statistics. It seems like next to things like lung cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer seem to be the two big cancers that affect men and women. What can you tell us about this? And is there any hope in terms of reducing those numbers or perhaps learning more about the cause?
Sure. Well, those are the two most commonly diagnosed cancers by gender, and that's largely due to the incidence of those two being high, as well as there being well-established screening programs to detect cancer in an early stage for both breast and prostate cancer. So we end up treating a lot of these patients and leading to the large numbers that you mentioned.
A trend that we've seen play out since the beginning of the year, the stock market seems to be tied to oil prices. On this Friday, the price of crude oil still above 30, but it's down, and the market's down on those bad unemployment numbers. The job numbers weren't as good as expected, but I guess the best news is for consumers, gasoline prices are cheaper. Joining us on the program is Kurt Wolf. And Kurt, let's begin with the price of oil. We sort of bottomed there in the $26 range last month. It's been bouncing up since then. I guess the good news is it's staying above 30. Given that, what's your outlook for oil here?
Jim, I like to believe that we did see the bottom at 26. I think there's an enormous amount of pessimism out there, and everybody's an oil expert on how low the price will go. I think we are on the bottom, and by the end of this year, we'll be up quite a bit. We're seeing the trends that demand is growing and supply is slowing. Demand is growing a little stronger than supply is slowing, but the slowing is picking up here in the U.S. The outlook for prices is better. We've probably got the best outlook today we've had for 18 months because we've been coming down for some 18 months, and the oil price decline is pretty well in the market right now.
One thing that we've seen is a major adjustment that has been taking place, at least on the U.S. side, and we're also seeing it with a lot of Western oil companies. They've reported a reduction in profits. More companies are laying off employees as they miss their earnings, and profits are down. In fact, in some companies like Chevron, they actually lost money. But so far, Exxon seems to be holding up. So given where we are right now and the fact that Iranian oil may be coming online this year, does that change your outlook for oil in any way?
We're seeing a kind of a sneaky turn in the stock prices. Oil stocks, they're not up, but they're outperforming the market this year. The market's down some 8%, and the median of my 25 stocks is down 4%, and Exxon is actually up this year for all the negative publicity that it gets. And we do hear from the rating agencies, and the rating agencies are the last people to recognize that an industry is under a little bit of pressure, and they may be a good contrary indicator. These are the people, you know, who told us that mortgage bonds were AAA, and then after the world collapsed, they said, well, they really weren't AAA. So I think all this negative stuff focused on the oil companies is a real sign of a peaking of sentiment and a turn in the other direction.
You know, one of the questions that has been raised is we've seen debt spreads widen over, let's say, the last year, especially in the lower quality bond area, especially in energy. There was concern that there would be a lot of defaults because many of these companies, even though the price of oil is low, they have to keep pumping oil because they have debt payments. Do you expect a lot of defaults in, let's say, some of these more highly leveraged companies this year?
I think that could still happen, even though I gave you that positive view on the very large companies. Some of my stocks might go out of business. I won't say which one, but one of them, of course, which got a huge amount of debt, is California Resources. The stock's already down to one, can't go below zero. And if they do pull out of this, you got manyfold upside on it. There's another one that's under a lot of pressure. I can't understand why Whiting is under so much pressure. My numbers don't come out as negatively as the stock price action seems to come out. And then we have my royalty trusts, which actually have no debt. And people are selling them like they're going out of business. But a royalty trust aren't going to go out of business. But I'm glad to say, though, that my royalty trust, which were down just as much as the highly leveraged companies last year, are all up this year. So they've gone through a turn. So I think maybe a couple of my companies do have default problems. But, you know, in the past, I wouldn't touch those kind of companies. But they're not going to go down much more. And maybe they'll give us some upside. You know, my overall approach is to be heavily invested in the big stocks, but then to be spread out among the small ones as well.
You know, Kurt, one thing that we've seen, and I just wonder what this portends for the future, is as you read these annual reports or earnings reports coming in from some of these oil companies, whether they're big or small, a lot of the big companies, especially the major integrated companies, have fared much better because they have downstream operations which have been profitable. But a lot of these companies have said that they're cutting back in a major way on CapEx spending in order to conserve cash flow to preserve that dividend. With the big oil companies, a lot of them have gone out of their way to stress the importance of maintaining that dividend.
Yeah, and there's no threat to the dividend of a company like Exxon. And the threat to the dividend comes more from the rating agencies. And the oil companies have pretty much said, well, we'll go with our own assessment. And if we're committed to a dividend, then we can cover it with our cash flow and maybe a little bit of dipping into our cash balances. We'll go with our own approach rather than listen to the rating agencies who say they're going to cut our debt if things don't get better. Of course, if things don't get better for a couple of years, maybe they shouldn't cut the debt. But the rating agencies typically, unduly conservative, and they're looking after the bondholders, not the stockholders.
So as you look at this, as companies from Exxon to Chevron to ConocoPhillips pull back on future, let's say, exploration, what does that mean down the road? Because you and I know that the oil industry is capital intensive. It takes a lot of money to go out and explore, drill, and turn something into producing well. In the meantime, Kurt, a lot of these companies are producing, and that's oil that's going out the front door. Sooner or later, they're going to have to replace it and find new deposits or new wells to replace what they're producing. So what does this mean for oil prices down the road?
Yeah, of course, if there isn't going to be any investment in new supply, supply will be dropping because it just goes down every year without any change. we have to invest just to replace our supply every year. That obviously is the case for a big comeback in prices, and even people like the International Energy Agency warn against that possibility. We've got one new development yesterday. Did you see that President Obama's proposing a $10 a barrel tax on oil?
You know, I heard it.
That's hard to believe.
It's insane. I mean, it's like the economy is weak and struggling. We're seeing the job numbers come down, as we saw on this Friday that were reported. And the last thing that the lower oil prices have helped the average consumer, but he's talking about putting a $10 tax. So imagine when oil prices go back up, how much it's going to cost.
Well, there's two ways to look at it. Before they go up, it'll be putting companies out of business for sure, because they're bouncing along right at their break-even cost now. Maybe the stronger companies have a break-even around $20 a barrel or even $10 a barrel, but there's a lot of companies that are underwater at $30. So you give them a $10 tax, and they're down for sure, and the rating agencies will put them out of business overnight. And then what happens is that we don't have the supply here in the U.S., and we just drive up world oil prices by $10 a barrel.
Yeah, that's a problem, too, because if you raise gas prices by $10, that's $10 that's not going to the oil companies, many of them that are struggling right now. But it's my understanding that that proposal is dead on arrival in Congress.
I think so, yeah. It's hard to believe it's even proposed. Maybe our sources are even wrong. Maybe somebody just spread that rumor. But no, nobody's picking up on it. It's not going anywhere.
So as you're looking at this industry, a lot of these companies that were highly leveraged, I would expect some of these companies aren't going to make it this year if oil prices remain at this level.
I think that's right. Some companies aren't going to make it to the end of the year if we stay at this level.
Do you expect us to stay in this $30 range? In other words, Kurt, if you and I were having this conversation December 31st, would you expect oil prices to be closer to 30 or over 40?
I'm still holding out for $70 by the end of the year. I know that's pretty high, but so maybe we don't make it. And I didn't think we'd have it for a whole quarter. But I think $50 later this year is probably a pretty widely held view. It may not be consensus, but it's a widely held view. But we don't know. And I'd like to bring up ConocoPhillips in that regard. I was giving you kind of a hard line on dividends, but ConocoPhillips did decide to cut their dividend by 2/3. And so they're being conservative. They don't know what's going to happen. And we investors can be diversified. We're going to be in business, whether these companies go out of business or not. We're going to be here. But if you're a ConocoPhillips and you got $30 for 3 or 4 or 5 years, you are out of business. So I don't think that's going to happen. If you went on a call, you know, some analyst asked, well, why didn't you hold out another year? And other analysts said, well, I'm glad you did this. And so there's a difference of opinion there. But ConocoPhillips, I think, took a conservative approach. They probably didn't have to, but they did. And those are the kind of considerations that a lot of people will have to go through. As investors, if we're diversified and we got big companies as well as small companies, we're in good shape. We can weather the storm if any of these little guys go out of business. We'll make it up when they come back.
So, Kurt, given the fact that you've seen major pullbacks in exploration that have been occurring over this downturn that we've experienced over the last 15 months, in terms of companies, in terms of the industry itself, it seems to me like those larger companies, like the integrated companies that we see, that they have the wherewithal to maintain their dividend and they can always ramp up. But it also seems like it would be a good time if you were a major and you did have cash flow to pick up some of these properties of these companies that are in financial trouble. Do you expect that to happen? In other words, if a company's in financial trouble, maybe some of the big guys just take them over.
Yeah, that's not happening as fast as you might think, but we did have Suncor buy Canadian Oil Sands. I would rather they didn't buy it because I think Canadian Oil Sands would have made it on their own. And anything that they're buying at this point, you don't want to be a seller in this market if you don't have to be. But it obviously is a buyer's market for oil and gas properties. And the companies which have the capital to do it, well, they're going to have to stand up to the rating agencies who might raise questions about it. But I think there will be compelling deals, and some of them will get done.
So, Kurt, given your assessment, I know you followed the large integrated, the mid-size, and even some of the royalty trust. If you had to place money right now, you know, there's the old saying in the market, you don't want to catch a falling knife. In your opinion, do you think we've sort of hit that bottom and it's safe to venture into this market? Or would you hold back here or just maybe put partial capital to work?
Well, I'd certainly put some to work because I think this is an unusual opportunity, and I have some of my clients are feeling aggressive in terms of establishing positions. They may be over the next 6 months. So presumably, we're going to get better oil prices in the second half of the year. So if we can put the money in the first half of the year, we'll be positioned for the second half of the year. But I can't really call it that close. So I think you should definitely have a substantial weighting of energy in your portfolio. I think there's a good chance that oil is going to be outperforming the stock market this year. The market has often run into trouble when oil gets down as low as it is right now. I hope the market doesn't go down. I just soon have it go up. But I would put my money on oil outperforming this year, not underperforming. So we put some money in, depending on who you are, 10, 20, 30% of your portfolio in oil and gas. The higher the percentage, maybe the bigger the proportion you'd put into the very big companies. They're quite safe. Exxon's as strong an investment as you can make in anything. Then after you put most of the allocation into the largest companies, you know, Exxon, Royal Dutch, Chevron, Total, those are my four largest companies. Then you can spread the rest around the large cap independents. My recommendations are the dicier ones, Marathon and Devon, but ConocoPhillips and EOG. EOG is the top quality in that group. Oxy's pretty secure. Then we have small cap independents, which are still underperforming the market. I think Whiting and Continental Resources have great upside potential. Whiting is a little bit dicey, apparently, by judging by the stock price action. I think the numbers are better than that. But, of course, in that group, Cimarex is very solid. Range Resources is up quite a bit this year. They're the big gas producer in Pennsylvania. They've been under a lot of pressure in recent years, but things are starting to look up for them. And then we have my royalty trusts, which are all quite small. But the median royalty trust is up 7% this year, which is kind of surprising in a down market, when the market's down 8%. And we have Canada. Canada might take a little longer to recover. Their costs are a little bit higher, but, of course, you might get a double whammy in Canada. That is, if oil prices improve again, the Canadian dollar will probably do a little bit better. Now, I do say that if you're aggressive, you follow some of my recommendations, which are the stocks like Birchcliff, a Canadian producer, a couple of royalty trusts, Whiting and Continental Resources, I mentioned, Devon and Marathon. But if you're a little more conservative, you might rather go with EOG, which is a great record, with Cimarex, a great record. And in Canada, maybe you want to own Imperial instead of in Canada.
Kurt, let me ask you this. You know, usually in the past, in some of these downturns, you've seen Exxon pick up major companies, whether it was a natural gas company or, you know, the last downturn in the 90s, they picked up Mobil. If you're a large cap company, your stock, obviously Exxon stock is down, Chevron stock is down. The majors have come down with the market, but not as much as the mid-tiered or smaller tiered companies. If you are producing oil and you're not finding any more of it, you're cutting back on your expenditures, why not pick up an oil company when their prices are cheap? It seems like that would be the easiest way to replace your reserves.
Yeah, and we've talked in the past about Chevron buying Cimarex as a good example. And even last week on their call, Chevron was telling how excited they were about their West Texas properties. So exciting is probably not the right word, but confident about the profitability at low prices, and Cimarex, of course, is their partner out there. But on the other hand, Chevron's under a little bit of pressure. They've got these big projects that have big cost overruns and are coming on now. Let's take Chevron as an example. Once they can see that things are turning, they maybe try to time it just right, you know, get in just before the oil price turns up and make their deal, and they won't get too much flack for it because people will see that their judgment's being vindicated fairly quickly. And, of course, that's the way this industry works. Once one company moves, then other companies move as well, and we can see a big wave all at once.
A couple things I'm taking away from this conversation, Kurt, is you think that we're probably closer to a bottom in oil. We don't know how long we'll stay in this area, but you would expect oil prices eventually to work their way back up. And given where we are right now, closer to a bottom, you would maybe put some money to work in the energy sector. It's already doing well. Of course, it's been hammered for almost 15 months now. If you're a safe investor, you might want to go with the larger companies. If you're more venturesome, you might want to go to some of your mid-tier or royalty trust. Does that pretty much sum it up?
Yeah, anything I'd say would just be elaborating on that, but that's the essence of it.
Okay, Kurt. Well, listen, as we close, you do some great work. If our listeners would like to find out more about your work, give out your website, if you would.
Yeah, my website is mcdepp.com. McDepp spelled M-C-D-P, like David Edward Peter. And on it, you can find my research for the last 15 years, but not for the last couple of weeks. So I put my research up for public access on a delayed basis. But you're welcome to sign up for the service and get it real time. That would cost money, of course.
Coming up next, a special edition of The Big Picture as Dr. Gary Schilling returns to the program. He is president of A. Gary Schilling & Company and the publisher of Insight. And under discussion now is Gary's book, The Age of Deleveraging. It's still relevant and still prescient in many of its forecasts. All of that coming up next as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.